All right, so let's dive into something pretty interesting. Imagine you're in law school, right? Maybe you just got totally fried by property law. You know how it is. And then you stumble across this crazy workplace situation, and it's like something straight out of a casebook. You know that? Like,
I know exactly what you
it's
mean.
like, okay, what if your firm, or really any workplace for that matter, had this rule saying that if two people working there got married, one of them has to quit?
Whoa.
That's intense, right? Because it feels kind of like overstepping boundaries, like getting into your personal life way too much.
Yeah, I can see how that would feel pretty invasive.
Well, get this, a case just like that actually went to court.
You're kidding?
Nope. And that's what we're going deep on today. The case of Vaughn v. Lawrenceburg Power System.
Vaughn v. Lawrenceburg Power System. All right, let's unpack that.
So this case, it really highlights this super tricky balance that often comes up, especially for public employers. It's like, how do you keep things running smoothly and efficiently while also respecting everyone's basic constitutional rights?
Right, because those two things can sometimes feel like they're at odds.
Totally. And in this case, we've got Keith and Jennifer Vaughn.
A married couple.
Exactly. They were both working for Lawrenceburg Power System, LPS for short.
Which, just to clarify for our listeners, LPS is a public utility. So we're talking about the public sector here, which, as you mentioned, adds another layer of complexity when it comes to constitutional rights.
Right, because those rights have even more weight when you're dealing with a government entity.
Exactly.
And to make things even more complicated, LPS had this anti-nepotism policy in place, basically saying that if two employees tied the knot, one of them had to say sayonara to their job.
Wow, so it was like a pick one love or livelihood kind of situation.
Yeah, pretty much. Can you imagine having to make that choice?
I mean, that's a tough one. Talk about a stressful start to married life.
For real. So you've got these two people working together. Their lives become intertwined. They fall in love, decide to get married, and then bam, this policy slams down and throws a wrench into everything. It's like their personal decision suddenly has these huge professional consequences. And what makes this case even more interesting is that the legal outcome wasn't just a simple yes or no.
It wasn't like a clear-cut victory for one side.
Nope. There were wins and losses for both sides. And those nuances, those shades of gray, especially where constitutional law comes in, are what make this case so fascinating to dissect.
It's not just about who sued who or the final verdict. It's about going deeper, understanding the why behind the court's decisions on each of the Vaughn's claims.
Exactly.
Like, what can this case teach us about the limits of workplace policies? Especially when we're talking about public employers and how those constitutional rights come into play even more directly. We're going to break down those key legal arguments, explore the court's logic, and ultimately grasp what it all means for how we view constitutional rights in the workplace.
All right, so let's get into the nitty-gritty here. Who were the main players in this whole saga? And how did this situation even unfold?
So, as we've said, we have Keith and Jennifer Vaughn as our employees,
Right.
and then we have Lawrenceburg Power System LPS, their employer, a government-run utility company.
Local government, right.
That's right. So both Keith and Jennifer were happily employed at LPS
Until.
until January 1998. That's when they got hitched. And this marriage boom immediately triggered LPS's anti-nepotism policy.
Talk about bad timing.
Right. The company basically told them, hey, one of you has to go. Our policy doesn't allow spouses to work here together.
Like their wedding gift was a pink slip.
Pretty much.
So did Keith or Jennifer just resign right then and there?
Actually, no. Neither one of them was like, oh, okay, sure, I'll quit. They actually pushed back.
Good for them.
Yeah, they stood their ground. And as a result, they're both suspended for 2 weeks for not playing by the rules.
So they were suspended for 2 weeks. And then what? What happened next?
Okay, so on February 9th, 1998, Keith showed up for work. Jennifer stayed home.
So one out of two.
Right. And then Keith had this meeting with LPS management, specifically with the LPS superintendent, a guy named Cato.
And I'm guessing that meeting didn't go so well.
It did not. Shortly after that, Keith was fired.
Ouch.
Yeah, the official reason LPS gave was insubordination. Jennifer was also let go around the same time because she didn't submit a formal resignation like the company had asked.
So both of them out of a job.
Exactly. Talk about a tough situation. I mean, you can understand why they decided to fight back legally, right?
Totally. So how did this case play out in the courts? Did they head straight to federal court?
Well, they actually started in the Tennessee state court system, but LPS, as they were totally allowed to do in these types of cases, had it moved to federal court.
Okay, so federal court it is.
Right. And once it landed in federal court, the case went to a magistrate judge, who basically recommended that most of the Vaughns' claims should be tossed out. The district court then pretty much agreed with the magistrate judge and granted what's called summary judgment in favor of LPS on most of the legal issues.
Okay, so round one, LPS wins.
You could say that. But the Vaughns, they weren't giving up. They appealed the decision.
They took it up the ladder.
They did. They took it to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. And that's where things got interesting. Because at this appellate level, some of those earlier rulings actually got flipped in the Vaughns' favor.
Oh, so there's a twist. All right, so we've got the policy, the marriage that set it all in motion, the terminations, the initial losses in court, and then boom, a partial victory on appeal. This is already more dramatic than my last contracts class.
Definitely keeps you on your toes.
For sure. Okay, so let's dive into the first big legal question that this case throws at us. Did this anti-nepotism policy actually violate Keith and Jennifer Vaughn's constitutional right to marry? I mean, it didn't explicitly say you can't get married, but it definitely created a pretty strong incentive not to.
Right. It's like a subtle pressure. Like, we're not saying you can't, but.
Right, exactly.
And that's the heart of the first legal challenge. The court used a two-part analysis to tackle this question. The first thing they looked at was whether the LPS policy directly burdened the fundamental right to marry or whether it was more of an indirect burden.
Okay, so direct versus indirect.
Right. And the court decided that the policy created what we call an indirect burden. As you said, it didn't flat out ban marriage like those laws that got struck down in cases like Loving v. Virginia.
Yeah, that was a landmark case.
For sure. But this policy, it did create a real and pretty significant economic consequence for choosing to get married. Like, one spouse might lose their job.
So it's like a domino effect. Get married, potentially lose a job, financial strain, tension in the marriage.
Yeah, it's not a direct hit on the right to marry, but it definitely creates ripples.
Okay, so it's a step removed from an outright ban. But because it was classified as an indirect burden, what kind of scrutiny did the policy have to face? Was it the same level as if it directly banned marriage?
Good question. So when it comes to laws and policies potentially infringing on constitutional rights, there are different levels of scrutiny that courts apply. And the level of scrutiny depends on the nature of the right and how directly the law or policy impacts that right.
Makes sense. You can't use a one-size-fits-all approach.
Exactly. So because the burden on the right to marry here was considered indirect, the court applied something called rational basis review.
Okay, rational basis review. And just for clarity, for anyone who might not be super familiar with legal jargon, what does that actually mean?
So rational basis review is a much less demanding standard of review compared to strict scrutiny.
And strict scrutiny is usually what's used for laws directly affecting fundamental rights.
You got it. Like the right to marry, free speech, right. Things like that.
Got it. So rational basis is kind of like the chill version of judicial review.
Yeah, you could say that. It's like the court is saying, we're not going to be super strict here. We just want to see if this policy makes sense in a general way.
Okay, so what are the judges looking for specifically when they apply rational basis review?
They're basically asking two main questions. First, does this policy serve a legitimate government interest? Like, is there a good reason for the government to have this policy in place?
And the second question,
is there a rational connection between the policy and that stated interest? Like, does it make sense? Is it a reasonable way to achieve that goal?
So they're not looking for the perfect solution or the most effective way to achieve the goal.
Right. It's more like, is this at least a plausible way to get there?
Okay, so legitimate interest and rational connection.
Got it. So in this specific case, what were the legitimate interests that LPS claimed their anti-nepotism policy was serving? LPS brought up a few things that we often see in these types of cases. One was the whole conflict of interest thing. You know, if spouses are working in the same organization, it could create situations where their personal relationship might influence their professional decisions.
Like showing favoritism or something.
Exactly.
Okay, so avoiding conflicts of interest, that makes sense. What else did they argue?
They also talked about preventing even the appearance of favoritism, even if nothing shady is actually happening. The perception of favoritism can be just as damaging to a workplace. It can create distrust and resentment among employees.
Okay, I could see that.
What else? Their last big argument was that the policy helps to create a more harmonious and efficient work environment overall. Like, by preventing those potential conflicts and perceptions of unfairness, they're trying to create a workplace where everyone feels like they're on a level playing field.
Right. So those are their legitimate interests.
Yeah.
And what did the court say? Did they buy it?
Yeah, the court basically said, okay, those are all valid concerns. Those are legitimate government objectives.
So the court was on board with the reasons behind the policy. And since the burden on marriage was indirect, and LPS had these pretty reasonable justifications for the policy, did the court ultimately decide that the policy itself didn't actually step on the Vaughns' constitutional right to marry?
That's right. The court said because the policy didn't outright forbid marriage, it just made it potentially tougher financially. And because LPS had these legitimate and rational reasons for having it, it passed the rational basis test.
Okay, so it cleared the bar, but barely.
You could say that. But that distinction is super important. It's the difference between something being outright unconstitutional and something being maybe not ideal, but still allowed under the law.
Right. But it's like the court is saying, look, we get it. This policy might not be perfect. It might make things a little harder for some couples, but it's not crossing that constitutional line.
Exactly.
All right. So the policy itself got the thumbs up from the court when it came to the right to marry. But there's another big piece to this legal puzzle, right? And this is where things get really juicy.
Oh, yeah, this is where it gets good.
It all centers on Keith Vaughn's termination and his rights under the First Amendment. So here's the situation. Keith was fired after saying that he would comply with the policy, but that he also disagreed with it.
Ah, interesting.
Right. Why did that specific statement carry so much weight with the court?
This is where we get into the whole idea of compelled speech, which is a big no-no under the First Amendment. The court was really worried that Keith Vaughn might have been fired not because he was refusing to follow the policy, because remember, he said he would comply, but because he dared to disagree with it. And that raises a huge red flag.
It's like they were trying to control his thoughts.
Exactly. Yeah. And the court was like, whoa, hold on a second. The government can't punish someone for what they think or believe, even if they're willing to follow the rules.
So it's about separating actions from beliefs.
Absolutely. It's like saying, you can make me do this, but you can't make me like it.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
And the First Amendment, it's not just about protecting our right to speak our minds. It's also about protecting our right to not speak, our right to think and believe whatever we want without the government interfering.
Right. It's like that classic line, I may not agree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it.
That's the spirit of the First Amendment. And the court actually brought up this really powerful quote from a Supreme Court case. It said that the government can't tell us what's right or wrong when it comes to opinions or force us to confess our beliefs.
So firing someone because they don't enthusiastically agree with a policy that's getting dangerously close to violating that core principle.
It's like walking a tightrope over a constitutional chasm.
That's a great visual. So even though the anti-nepotism policy got the okay under that rational basis review thing, the possibility that Keith was fired just for disagreeing with it triggered a whole different level of scrutiny under the First Amendment.
Precisely. The court was like, hold up. This raises a serious constitutional question. They recognize that if Keith was fired simply for voicing his disagreement, even though he was going to comply, that could be illegal retaliation.
It's like the court is saying, you can enforce your policies, but you can't force people to love them.
Right. And that's a really important distinction, especially when we're talking about public employers. They have power, but that power has limits.
So what happened with this First Amendment claim? Did the Sixth Circuit make a final decision on whether Keith's firing was retaliation?
They didn't give a definitive answer. They basically said, look, there are still some unanswered questions here about what really went down with Keith's firing. We need more info.
Like what specifically?
Well, the big question was whether he was fired for actual insubordination, like maybe he was rude or disrespectful during that meeting with the superintendent, or if he was fired purely because he said he didn't like the policy.
So it all boils down to the reason behind his firing.
Exactly. And because those crucial facts were still up in the air, the appellate court actually reversed the district court's decision to grant summary judgment in favor of LPS on that First Amendment retaliation claim. They sent it back down to the lower court for more digging to figure out the real motivation behind Keith's termination.
So back to the lower court to figure out, was it his actions or his beliefs that got him fired? That's a huge distinction to make. Now, if I remember correctly, there was also a claim under the Tennessee Human Rights Act, right? What happened with that?
Oh, yeah, you're right. The Vaughns also claimed that the anti-nepotism policy and their firings were a form of illegal discrimination under Tennessee state law. But after looking at all the evidence, the court decided that the Vaughns hadn't really backed up this particular claim.
Like they didn't have enough proof.
Exactly. So the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals actually upheld the district court's decision to dismiss the Tennessee Human Rights Act claim.
All right, so just to recap where we are. The anti-nepotism policy itself was deemed constitutional when challenged, based on the right to marry. The First Amendment retaliation claim about Keith's firing was sent back to the lower court to figure out what really happened, and the state law discrimination claim was dismissed.
That's a good summary.
So for our listeners out there, many of whom are probably knee-deep in law school, what are the big lessons to take away from this case? What does Vaughn v. Lawrenceburg power system really mean for them as they navigate the legal world?
I think there are a few key takeaways here, especially for those who might end up working with or advising public employers. The main message is that while public employers have a lot of leeway to create policies that make sense for how they operate, they need to be super careful about how they enforce those policies, especially when those policies bump up against employees' constitutional rights.
Right, because those rights are not to be trifled with.
Exactly. And Vaughn v. Lawrenceburg power system really emphasizes that there's a crucial difference between making someone comply with a rule and making them believe in that rule.
It's like you said before, you can force the action, but you can't force the agreement.
Right. And if a public employer tries to punish an employee just for expressing disagreement, even if they're ultimately going to follow the rule, that can get them into hot water constitutionally.
It's a good reminder for anyone going into public sector employment law.
Mm-hmm.
Focus on the behavior, is the employee following the rules, and don't get caught up in trying to control their thoughts and opinions.
Absolutely. And for law students, this case is like a gold mine for understanding some fundamental constitutional law concepts.
How so?
Well, for one, it shows how courts often use this two-step process to analyze situations where a law or policy might be infringing on a fundamental right, like the right to marry.
The direct versus indirect thing?
Exactly. And then the different levels of scrutiny, strict scrutiny for direct burdens and rational basis review for indirect burdens.
Okay, so it's a good illustration of that concept in action.
Right. And it also gives a real-world example of how the compelled speech doctrine under the First Amendment works, especially in public sector employment.
It's like a case study come to life.
Yeah, pretty much. And the main takeaway there is that employers can regulate what employees do, but they generally can't punish them just for thinking or believing something different or for speaking out against a policy.
And this case really highlights that core First Amendment idea. The government can't dictate what's considered the right opinion.
It's so important.
It's not enough for a public employee to just follow the rules. What they think and believe, as long as it doesn't stop them from doing their job, is their business. Especially when it comes to speaking out against those rules.
It's about respecting individual freedom of thought.
Exactly. So to wrap things up, I got a question for our listeners to chew on as they continue their legal journey.
Hit us with it.
So we've talked about this idea of indirect burden on a fundamental right and the whole no compelled speech thing.
Right.
How do you think those legal principles could apply to other workplace policies that might touch on an employee's personal beliefs or affiliations?
Ooh, that's a good one.
For example, think about mandatory diversity, equity, and inclusion training programs.
Oh, yeah. Those are becoming pretty common.
Right. So how far can employers go? Can they require employees to not only attend, but also to express agreement with the ideas behind those programs?
Right. Because that gets into tricky territory.
It does. Or think about the whole debate around vaccine mandates.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we draw the line between an employer requiring vaccination as a condition of employment and prying into an employee's personal reasons for being hesitant or their beliefs about vaccines?
Right, because those are often deeply held beliefs.
Exactly. So these are some complex and super relevant issues for you all to think about as you continue your legal studies and start to grapple with how constitutional law plays out in the real world. It's not always black and white.
It's definitely full of those gray areas.
And that's what makes it so fascinating.
Absolutely.
All right, that's a wrap for our deep dive on Vaughn v. Lawrenceburg power system. Hope you all enjoyed the ride.
Until next time.
Catch you later.